So one of the ways of developing a meditation practice is to learn from your own experience. So learning from your own experience, one of the ways of doing that is to spend a little bit of time at the end of a sitting, every sitting, a minute, 2 minutes, just reviewing what that sitting was like. And there's the art to this kind of reviewing. Part of the art, or part of the way of doing it, is not to do it in a way that is critical or judgmental, but rather just kind of very matter of fact, kind of like you're a naturalist. This is what happened. And the recognizing, acknowledging of what happened supports and strengthens the tendency of the mind to pay more attention. If you know you're going to be kind of reviewing at the end of a sitting, there can be a little kind of almost unconscious nudge, okay, stay more present for your experience as you're meditating. Also, when you review your experience, you can learn a little bit about what happened in the sitting. Maybe you knew what happened, but acknowledge it in a deeper level. Oh, I was rather complacent. I had a lot of thoughts, and I just kind of willingly went sailing off my thoughts freely. I wasn't that interested in meditating today. I could have probably very easily applied myself more, but I didn't. And just that full recognition of that in a matter-of-fact way, next time when you come to sit, you might have a little more, oh yeah, I think I'll just apply myself more. I'm not going to let another sitting go by where I'm so complacent. Maybe you notice by reviewing the experience that a lot of your experience was judgmental, kind of judging your experience every few minutes or every minute or every few seconds. You know, this is not good enough, or this is not right, or I should be doing it better. And you notice that, and say, oh, that's a tendency I have. Maybe next time I sit, I should be a little more alert not to kind of buy into that tendency. Maybe let go of it quicker. So there's a lot you can learn about your meditation by reviewing it and letting it sink in. And kind of take a whole, it's a way of taking meditation more seriously. Learning from it, learning from your own experience. And then when you come back to sit, you come with more familiarity, more knowledge, more experience that you can draw upon. Then they can help maybe day by day to let your meditating experience go deeper and deeper. Kind of more fully enter that world of meditation, into the world of being fully present for your experience. So one of the things I said during the sitting is that one of the simplest meditation instructions in Buddhism that I know of is the instruction to set yourself at ease and then notice what takes you away from that. That's all. And generally, if you really notice well what takes you away from a sense of ease, it kind of brings you back to some kind of ease. You study it, you get to know it. Eventually, maybe it'll let go of itself, or you can let go of it, or you really see it. I'm concerned about what I'm going to have for breakfast. I'm anxious about that. I'll let go of that. I don't have to think about that. I'm meditating now. Breakfast can wait for tomorrow morning. And ease is a relative thing. If you're feeling a lot of unease, maybe it's not going to look very great, the kind of ease you have. But you can kind of soften a little bit around what's going on. And then that softening, then noticing the tendency to kind of tighten up again. Set yourself at some ease, then notice what takes you away. You'll learn a lot about yourself if you pay careful attention to what takes you away from a sense of ease. A lot. And you should study that, get to know it well. Get to know what it is, what are the forces in your psyche that take you away. And ease, spiritual or mental or heart ease, is not the same thing as physical discomfort. But it's the way we relate to discomfort, the way we relate to what's going on. Ease and dis-ease and unease has to do with movements in our own psyche. And so by looking at where we lose our ease, we begin taking some responsibility for those movements of the psyche. I'm anxious about breakfast. Do I need to be? Is that just a given that I have to be? Am I supposed to be? Are human beings required to be anxious about breakfast? Or is the anxiety about breakfast something that's optional, something you can let go of? The teaching of Buddhism, in a kind of nutshell, is that the forces that take us away from a sense of ease are all forces that we can let go of, that are optional. And so we learn to take responsibility for that movement. Study it, get to know it, get familiar with it. And by getting to know it really well, then learn how to either resolve them or dissolve them, or how not to get caught by them, how to be free of them, free of them or free from them. To kind of beginning to have a wise relationship to the world of unease. As we do that, the hope of Buddhism, the promise of Buddhism in a sense, is that we can start living a life of greater and greater ease. Ease can be a more normal part of our life. But you have to learn about yourself first. One of the very interesting questions for every person, I believe, is for what are you willing to sacrifice your ease, your peace? For what? You get up in the morning, you meditate, you get some kind of peace, some ease, some presence through your meditation. Your meditation session's over, and you're getting out of your meditation, and you notice that you immediately get anxious. What was that about? You had this wonderful thing. You had some peace. Why were you willing to give up that peace and get anxious? For what? What was that breakfast thing again? You know, you want to have the right breakfast. You know, if you don't have the right breakfast, then your coworkers are going to think you're not a good person. Cool. Because there's a right breakfast to have in California. Low carb these days. High protein. And you don't have enough protein. Anyway, go on and on, right? So you're willing to sacrifice your ease by the belief that you have to look a certain way to your coworkers, by the idea that it has to be, you know, some all kinds of things. That's a silly example, but what are you willing to sacrifice your ease for? You get in your car, and you find yourself after a while that you're not as at calm as you were before you got in your car, and the only thing it took for you to sacrifice it was a desire to get to where you're going 10 seconds faster. And so you're a little bit tense at the steering wheel, kind of pushing a little bit, and the mind gets a little agitated. Is it worth sacrificing your calm and your peace for those 10 seconds? So part of this exercise then is to begin questioning the beliefs, the values, the feelings, the motivations that unconsciously justify sacrificing your ease. What comes to mind right now is some families, maybe other places also, but from some family systems, the only way of expressing love between family members is if there's worry. And so you have to worry appropriately so people know you care. So people sacrifice their peace and their calm so they can worry properly. Is it worth a sacrifice? Maybe it is. I'm not going to say it's not. But have you ever questioned whether it's worth it? What are you willing to sacrifice your ease for, your peace for, your calm for? You learn so much about yourself. So much. There's a teaching that I do often around how you should be, if you want to go to the savannas of Africa and be a nature photographer, take pictures of all the wild animals. There's two general approaches, perhaps. One is you just wander around the savannas, the plains, looking for the animals until you try to get all the animals. You can picture every single one. And you might have to spend days and years kind of looking around, and some of them are kind of reclusive. That's one strategy. And the other strategy is to sit by the watering hole and wait. And all the animals in the savannas eventually have to come to the watering hole. Not they have to wait very long. This very thing about ease and the loss of ease is the watering hole, is a spiritual watering hole. Everything that you need to know about yourself that's spiritually important will appear at that juncture between your ease and your lack of ease. So it's a very important place to pay attention. You might not want to spend a lot of time in meditation reflecting and exploring all this. Maybe then you just let go. But after meditation, or as you go about your life, it's been very useful to explore and question the authority of the unconscious beliefs that cause you to sacrifice your calm, your peace, your ease. What's going on there? I mean, question deeply, look at it deeply. And then begin exercising a particular muscle that every human being has, but often it's not very well developed. And so one of the things we're doing in Buddhist spirituality is learning to exercise this muscle so it becomes a strong. It becomes strong, it becomes a strength. And that's the muscle of letting go. Learning to let go. You don't want to let go of everything and anything. But you want to let go. You don't have the ability and the strength to let go of the things that you don't want to hold on to anymore. If something's not useful to hold on to, let go. The image of someone holding onto a hot air balloon. And they're standing on the ground, they're holding the rope of the hot air balloon. And the hot air balloon starts taking off. And you're still holding on. It's not very useful to keep holding. It's dangerous. You know, if the hot air balloon goes up, let go. But you're still standing. Not 10, 20, 50 feet up. So to learn to let go is to have that ability. If you have the ability to let go, then you may or may not let go as is useful. But a lot of people haven't really developed that ability to let go at all to begin with. And so they don't have the choice. They don't have the ability to use their wisdom. So part of Buddhist practice is to learn to exercise and develop that capacity to let go. So when we see some movement to unease, where we're sacrificing our ease because we're attached to something, that we have the ability then, oh, I don't have to do that, thank you. And we can let go. And come back to some sense of ease. Letting go doesn't mean living an irresponsible life. A life that doesn't respond to life, to our situations. It means that when we respond, we do so with some level of ease and peace. So if your family requires you to worry, maybe you let go of the worry, but you still, you know, drive your old aunt to the doctor. But you don't, you know, worry the whole way there with her. You don't kind of do this kind of, co-conspirators around worrying, you know, like what could happen. You know, you stay calm and you're engaged, but you don't sacrifice your ease even though you're taking care of your responsibility, trying to be helpful. So that, in a nutshell, is all of Buddhism. Isn't that simple? You don't have to learn anything more about Buddhism. Let yourself establish some sense of ease. Notice what takes you away. Question that. And learn to let go. Isn't that great? In a sense, what I'm pointing to here is a summary of the most important teaching of Buddhism, which is called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is the Buddha's way, one of the Buddha's ways of trying to encapsulate this basic simple idea I was trying to get across today. And the word truth is frightening to people sometimes because, you know, it's a spiritual thing. You know, I'm not sure I want to be a Buddhist and these truths, you know, dogma, creed and all that. But so maybe do away with the word truth. But the four noble statements, the four noble perspectives, the four frameworks for look, it's kind of like an orientation for understanding our lives. Here in the West, we have the English system for measuring distance and weight and all that. In much of Europe, they have the metric system. Is one ultimately better than the other? They're just kind of arbitrary how human beings have come up with this to some degree. And And each of them isn't necessary. Each society needs to have a system of measurement so that people can talk to each other. The Four Noble Truths are kind of a way, orientation, a perspective for helping us understand our lives. And it's so the first perspective is it's useful to recognize when there is suffering. And the word suffering in Buddhism is kind of like the key word. It kind of covers everything. Any movement away from our ease. Unease is this, so we notice our unease. Once we've noticed our unease, then we try to understand what is it that has prompted that unease, that suffering. If some close loved person has died and you feel grief, that's pain, it's a kind of suffering. And that might be completely reasonable for a human heart to feel that way. It's not, and you don't want to necessarily stop feeling that level of grief that might be there. But perhaps there's embarrassment about the grief. Or perhaps, some people are embarrassed after a week or a month or a year, and they don't want to show it. Or perhaps they're attached to something, or they're frightened, or they feel some level of responsibility. They're clinging to some fear connected to the loss. And so the grief gets very complicated sometimes with a lot of the extra thing that doesn't have to be part of it. The unease that we're trying to look at is all that extra stuff by our fears, our attachment, our pushing away of something. So we try to understand what is the nature of our unease. What are we holding on to? What are we resisting? And that takes sometimes some very careful attention. It's not always obvious at first what it is we're holding on to. So for example, I might be attached to the clothes I wear. As someone said, a lot of people pay more attention to what they wear than the words they use. They talk, it's kind of casually and freely. So I might be attached to the clothes I wear. And the fact that I have, an old shirt on or something might make me feel uncomfortable. I lose my ease in front of all these wonderful people here. And, it's kind of embarrassing to be a Dharma teacher and have a shirt that has paint on it. And, it's like not cool. I should be more, dignified or something, right? Than an old shirt. So if I get anxious about what I'm wearing in front of all of you, that's my unease. So what is that about? Well, on the surface, it looks like I'm just, anxious about how you see me. But if you go more deeply into myself, it might be that I have a certain attachment to having a particular image of myself. I'm supposed to be a really cool dresser or a really cool something or other. And so I'm attached to something deeper. But if I go deeper than that, what am I attached to? Not simply the image of myself or some identity that I'm holding on to. But perhaps what's really that deeper is that I'm attached to some degree of wanting to be liked. And the whole idea of holding on to an image is trying to get myself liked by a lot of people. And that's what I'm holding on to. And so I'm sacrificing my calm by that impulse to try to find how to be liked by other people. But then scratch the surface a little bit further. What's that coming from? It's my discomfort, my pulling away from feeling lonely or feeling insecure. And so I'm sacrificing my ease because I'm reacting, I'm uncomfortable with being insecure. Is that making some sense? So the first noble truth is notice our unease. The second one is to then get to know what that's like. What's prompting that unease? What's the causes of it? The Buddha gave four different primary causes. I don't know if they cover everything that you've, in your experience, but maybe it's useful just to give you that list and you can kind of see. The first is the attachment or clinging to sensual comfort or sensual desire, sensual pleasure. The second is attachment to existence, to being someone, to having an identity, a self-image, to feel like you have to represent yourself in a certain way. We are what we are, and then we represent ourselves as something a little bit different. The third is clinging to our opinions. Some people are willing to sacrifice their ease because of their attachment to opinions. I think a lot of people lost their cool, their calm, their peace after the election or before the election because of that particular one. And then the fourth is attachment to self, clinging to self. It isn't that you're supposed to not be a self, be somebody, you know, be a human being, but it's the clinging to it which can cause, is one of the primary forms of dis-ease or unease, the arising of it. So the first noble truth is unease. Stop, look at it, get to know it. The second noble truth is understand the causes of it, what prompted it. The third noble truth is the letting go. The possibility of letting go and coming back to the ease of ending the causes, of seizing the causes, of letting go of that clinging, that holding, whatever it might be. That sounds very simple in principle. Notice the suffering, notice the clinging, and let go of it. It's not so simple. In some areas of our life, it's very simple to do, like breakfast thoughts, maybe. But some areas of life, it's very hard to do. And it's very hard to do it thoroughly, completely. If you do it thoroughly, you become a Buddha. So to do it really thoroughly is very hard. So because it's not so easy, the Buddha offered a path, what he called a path. And it's the path which supports or makes possible deep letting go. And so it's the Buddha's eight-step program. Yes, every human being, until they're, you know, can say, yes, hi, I'm Gil, I'm a recovering addict. You know, that Buddhism is trying to deal with addiction. Some of you are addicted to your thoughts. That's the primary suffering. Addicted to all kinds of things. And so there's this eight-step program. And I've heard that in recent years it's been developed further. Now they have a 12-step program, which is very, very effective, I hear. But it's an 8-step program of the Buddha. And the first of these 8 steps is to understand the first 3 truths. To understand how to, that to under, just to understand that principle, to notice your unease, notice the cause, and notice the possibility of letting go. Just to know that in principle, or study it, or get to know that, to look at your experience that way. And that's not always so easy, because often we want explanations, we think it's more complicated than it is. We're not going to let go until we understand all the intricacies of the Buddhist teachings of emptiness, or whatever. You know, we feel like we have to understand a lot. So the first step of the Eightfold Path is to learn to train oneself to tune into unease, the cause, and the possibility, at least, of letting go. That part of our experience. To be inspired by that, to be informed by that, to be encouraged by that, to find our way forward, find the path of practice by recognizing the simplicity of it. Right here with those 3 things. The second part of the path is called right attitude. Right intention or right motivation. And this has to do with the approach, the disposition that we have as we engage in this exploration of suffering. And it turns out, if you really want to engage in exploring suffering and free yourself from suffering, it helps if you have an attitude which is nonviolent, which is not, you know, adding more suffering and more harm. It kind of goes across purposes. If you're trying to be violent or conflictive with your experience or yourself or your neighbors, how can you study, how can you really focus on studying the source, the root of suffering, if you're causing suffering? So there needs to be some attitude of non-harming. The second is a willingness to let go. An attitude of letting go, or of simplicity. The third is kindness. It helps to be kind. So kind to oneself, kind to one's neighbors, just kind, have a disposition, an attitude of kindness. It's a lot easier to engage in this whole area of suffering and freedom from suffering, understand it, to if there's kindness as part of it, a friendliness in the whole thing. A friendly, nice, warm kind of attitude towards it all. If you want to do this work, it also helps if your behavior is aligned with not causing more harm, or with not aligned with the principle of learning to let go of our deep clinging. And so the fourth, fifth, and sixth steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with our behavior. The fourth one is right action, which involves, you know, not killing or stealing or harming people through our sexuality or lying or speaking in unwise ways. So paying attention to our actions. So our actions are aligned with this movement to stay with our ease. And if you study ethical behavior, what you probably discover is that most of the movements to be unethical entail a loss of our ease, entail some kind of unease somewhere in our psyche. I don't think anybody can lie or steal or kill without some kind of feeling of unease. So it goes, you know, to move towards greater ease or peace, you need to kind of support that by refraining from those actions which are opposed to it. Just makes perfect sense, right? So right action. So in a sense, Buddhist ethics is not so moralistic as it is pragmatic. This is what helps and supports the movement towards peace. The fifth of these Eightfold Steps is right speech. Speech is such an important part of learning to be free and become peaceful that learning to pay attention to your speech and be wise about it is indispensable. The sixth step is right livelihood. Most people spend a huge majority of their day engaged in their livelihood. And so hopefully your livelihood is in harmony with that movement towards peace, towards freedom. And then the sixth, seventh, and eighth step. The sixth step is right effort. The seventh is right mindfulness. And the eighth is right concentration. And these are the trainings of Buddhism. This is where you have to make, you know, start applying yourself to this inner life. So, 4, 5, and 6 have to do with behavior. No, 3, 4, and 5 have to do with behavior, and 5, 6, 3, 4, 5, and 6, 7, 8 have to do with then beginning to work on our inner life, our mental life, or our psychic life, or our spiritual life. Beginning to work with it, adjust it, change it. Make the effort to do something about it. And as we do something about it, to learn how to get... One of the things we can do about it is to cultivate our mindfulness and cultivate our stability of mind. The more stable you are, the easier it is to see the movement from ease to unease and from unease back to ease. Part of part of the value of becoming very deeply concentrated in meditation is it's in very deep states of concentration that you can have a very deep qualitative experience of ease. That's qualitatively, quantitatively, very different than the kind of peace that most people can attain in daily life. And in that deep concentrated state, you get a very different perspective on how deep the possibility is for liberation in the psyche, to let go more deeply. One of my favorite little kind of analogies that probably some of you have heard before from me is that of that I learned from a yoga teacher many years ago, that if you can't get into the triangle pose, which involves kind of bending over and trying to get one hand down on the ground really low, if you can't get stretched far enough down to get that hand down, you get a whole bunch of telephone books. And you stack them up until you can rest your hand in the telephone books. And you do the pose every day. And every day you tear out one telephone book page. And one page makes almost no difference. You know, telephone pages are really thin. But if you keep doing it every day, eventually all the pages will be thrown away and your hand will have reached the floor. Your body will have stretched out. Almost imperceptibly, you'll feel the stretching. The stretching will be imperceptible each day, but definitely it'll develop over the time. The possibility of spiritual growth, the possibility of growing in the freedom from unease, freedom from attachment, from clinging, the possibility of growing into a heart which is unbounded, is free, is open, relaxed, at home with itself, liberated. That possibility is something we can all attain. And I think it's helpful to think about it as something that's attainable, if you want, in small little steps. You put it together enough little steps, you'll go really far if you keep it up, maintain it. So to engage in the mindfulness practice day after day, to engage in this reflection, this exploration of the Four Noble Truths, or engage in the reflection, the study of peace and the loss of it, to take that really serious. Take it as with a watering hole. Everything you need to know, everything you need to experience that's really necessary for the spiritual life, will come visiting you if you hang out right there at that juncture, that watering hole. Take that seriously. Cultivate and develop the different qualities of the path. So those are my thoughts about the Four Noble Truths and the way they support mindfulness practice. They're integral to the whole process. Do you have any questions or any thoughts about that? Allison will pass out the mic if someone does. Our talking stick.
I don't need the mic. I really like them.
You don't need it, but someone else does.
How does it work?
Just have it close to your mouth. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, I was just going to say that I like life is disease better than saying life is suffering. I mean, that works a lot better with me.
So she said that the statement life is disease works better than the statement life is suffering. It's a common misperception that the Buddha taught that life is suffering as the first noble truth. And then it seems like Buddhism is just a party pooper. I mean, if life is suffering, what's left? But he never said that. What he said in the first noble truth, he said, there is suffering. Basically said there is suffering in life, but he didn't equate life with suffering. And it's hard to argue with that. There is suffering. But the First Noble Truth is you need to pay attention to it. You need to notice it. But I agree with you that sometimes it's better to translate it as unease or dis-ease than suffering. I think it kind of talks more to the point. There is unease, there is dis-ease, and there's a possibility for ease. Yes?
I didn't get it. What's the Fourth Noble Truth?
The Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path. Can you pass it over here to George? Oh.
I was wondering, and I also heard, the Second Noble Truth is greed or aversion and ignorance, but ignorance or delusion, or sometimes I just hear that, and I'm kind of unclear about delusion or ignorance, what exactly is that entails, or in the teachings.
The literal word that Buddha used to define the Second Noble Truth, which is the cause of suffering, is the word thirst. To be thirst, to have thirst, like a thirst for power or something like that. And so thirst is not a very technical word, so it kind of lends itself to kind of different kind of interpretations or meanings. But sometimes thirst is translated into English as desire. The Second Noble Truth is desire. But the problem with that is that not all desires are a problem. Not all desires cause suffering. Some desires cause suffering. The ones that are thirsty, or the ones that are addicted, or those that there's a drivenness or a compulsion behind the desire. So sometimes I like to think of the Second Noble Truth as drivenness. We're driven in certain directions. When we're driven, we're not free. And there's a kind of suffering as part of that. So Buddhism has a lot of different lists of the nature of attachment, the different kinds of attachment. And one very common one is greed, hate, and delusion. Those are the forms that it takes. And usually the Second Noble Truth is not described as greed, hate, and delusion as being the cause, but it could. And so the question is, what are they? What is delusion?
Ignorance.
Ignorance is usually in the Buddhist tradition understood as the act of ignoring. It's not simply the absence of knowing something, but it's the act of not ignoring what's really going on. So it's just kind of a movement of turning away or something. And it's primarily one of the things it's an ignoring of the Four Noble Truths. People don't, I don't want to notice that I'm suffering. I'm not going to pay attention to that. But if you don't notice you're suffering, how can you do anything about it? Delusion is a little bit different than ignorance. Delusion is you see what you see, but you overlay what you see with a projection that's not there. That's not true. So we're deluded about what we're seeing. Over here, yes. We're going to get a second mic, and that will be easier for passing it around.
Liberation. This is my question. I understand that once you return to the ease, you feel liberated. And my question, is there more to liberation than just than returning to ease?
Well, yes and no. There are layers and layers of ease. So, someone who has been out in the hot sun all day working hard and thirsty, and they finally come in the shade and there's a nice cool drink of water, they feel a certain level of ease. But after a while they get habituated to that, they realize that actually there's other layers in their psyche where they're actually very worried about something else, And it's been put on hold for the time being because they've been focusing on the hot heat and relief from it. But it's still there, kind of underneath. And so what we find is we establish some sense of ease. And it's always going to be, for a long time, it's going to be quite relative to where we have been. And from that platform of some level of ease, modicum of ease, then we have the possibility of seeing where the attachment is that keeps us from a deeper level. And so we go deeper and deeper, or more and more thorough, or more complete, or bigger, or higher, you know, it depends on the, how you want to talk about it. And so it's very important, or not important, but it's important not to get too complacent. And some people settle for too little. They get a little bit of relief, they feel like they're coping better in their life, and that's fine. And that's not, you know, liberation in, from the Buddhist point of view, liberation is a radical transformation of the consciousness of psyche.
And what is that transformation of consciousness?
It's the complete and thorough letting go of every possible clinging in the mind or the heart.
And the outcome is a liberation.
Liberation, freedom, happiness, well-being, peace, joy.
Sounds good.
Enough? I was planning to have a sit again for a little while. That was the plan. But I'm not going to sacrifice my well-being for that. That agenda. And I'll let go of it since it's 9 o'clock. And so I hope this little 3-week course has been useful for you, these things. And I hope that it serves you in helping you find a greater peace and well-being in your life. And if it doesn't, that should be very interesting to understand why. So, thank you.